This afternoon, we're going to have a look at the Bodhi Raja Kumara Sutta. Discourse given by the Buddha to Prince Bodhi. Now, this particular sutta has various parallels. Curiously enough, it doesn't have any direct parallels in the Chinese Agamas. However, it does have substantial parts of it are included within other Pali suttas, and moreover, there is also a version of it found within the Mahishasaka Vinaya, the five-part Vinaya, which is a Chinese reference here. And there's a partial parallel also within the Vinaya, as we'll see. Part of the story revolves around setting up a Vinaya rule, and then we have these various Sanskrit fragments which are listed here on Sutta Central. These from Eastern Turkestan. This one is probably from Afghanistan, I would think. This one's similar. And so this one's from Turfan. So the reason why this is not found in the Agamas, and this is an interesting case as to the question of when we find suttas, corresponding suttas that are either present or absent. Now, the reason why it's not found in the Agamas is because we see here that it's found in the Dirghagama of the Mulasarvasivadins, okay, which is a recent Sanskrit finding. And if I just, where will I find that? I'll find it right here. Actually have the Sanskrit text of part of that has been published. So this is an excellent article by Hartman, who analyzes the structure of it. It's a few years old, they're still working on it, but they've got a list of the structure of the suttas and so on in there, and looks at a table of them. And at the end here, he has the text of large part or of a large fragment of the Bodhi Raja Kumara Sutta. And so here's the actual Sanskrit text. So it may not mean much to those of you who don't speak Sanskrit. But isn't that amazing? Exactly. But isn't that amazing? You see? This has been lost in the deserts of Afghanistan for nearly 2,000 years, and a completely unknown text. There's no unknown in the sense that this particular version is not found in the Chinese or Tibetan translation. Lost in the desert sands. How romantic is that? And then somehow it appears in some second-hand camel dealer's yard, and someone comes up with a jar of manuscripts and says, do you want to buy this thing? And so then they have to buy it, usually sight unseen. They don't know what they're getting, and then they take it away and they recognize, well, it's Sanskrit, they recognize it's a Buddhist text. They sort of go to work on it and they recognize, oh, there are these parallels. And then somebody sits there with these incredibly fragile 1,000-year-old manuscripts and pieces together, letter by letter, the text. It would describe it up there. They're usually in a version of either Brahmi or Kharoshti. This one's probably in Brahmi. Brahmi being the ones which are scripts which are related to or derived from the ancient Ashokan edicts. So the Brahmi school of scripts includes almost all the mainstream Indian scripts today, as well as Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand and Cambodia and so on. That's a kind of Brahmi family, all of which is descended from the Ashokan inscriptions.
Are these the ones that, you know, there's a book down in the library very nice to have those pictures on them.
Yeah.
And the pictures of the jars and.
Yeah, that's.
Is it these ones?
No, that's a different collection. That's the Gandhari collection. It's similar though. This one is not as old as the Gandhari stuff, but still very old.
Is it found more recently?
About the same time. Yeah.
Right, and when was that?
Late end of the 90s.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine there's many of them left anyway.
Well, this is the thing. Yeah,
they're
disintegrating fast.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah.
Not in this paper. We might be able to find one somewhere. So, if it's Kharoshthi is the other script, and Kharoshthi, I'm just trying to see which one this one is. Kharoshthi is related to the Persian scripts, rather than the Brahmi school of scripts, and the texts which are found in this region, the kind of Afghanistan and Gandhara region, are found in both Kharoshthi and Brahmi, as it says here, two scripts used side by side for several centuries. So this is okay. So this is a Brahmi manuscript. And first glimpsed in the last years of the 90s, when bundles of it, each consisting of 55 to 70 folios, which is quite large, that's about a third of the Digha Nikaya, roughly, began to reach the Western market. In 1999, a Japanese scholar published a photograph which had been made available to him by a manuscript dealer, and the suspicion that all these bundles belonged to a manuscript containing a Sanskrit version of the Dirghagama, a collection of long discourses of the Buddha, was confirmed when the last folio became available for scholarly inspection. Last folio meaning the final one in the collection, not the last one in existence, because part of it is not, as it says, it's still not there. It contained a brief colophon, its last sentence stating Samaptascha Dirghagama, and finished is the long collection. At present, approximately 55% of the manuscript is known to have made its way into three private collections, one in Japan, one in Norway, and the other in the USA. The whereabouts of the remaining parts are still a matter of speculation. So someone in probably Afghanistan or somewhere has found these things. It's quite likely the manuscript was complete when it was found. It was probably broken into bits and sold to various private dealers, and as it says, just over half of it is now available for scholarly interests, and the other rest of it is still unknown. It could have been just lost, could have been destroyed in the process of recovering it, it could have made its way into the hands of a collector who preferred to just keep it for himself. So this has been lost for such a long period of time, and finally, here we have it. We can just read that in the Sanskrit. All we have to do is learn Sanskrit, and then away we go. And of course, these being all the different marks for the lacuna and problems with the text, so each one of these having a specific meaning in terms of this being like a probable reconstruction and so on of the actual text. So this is the reasonable section of the Sanskrit, and there he's given a translation here as well. So if anyone wants to look at that in more detail, we can do that. We'll go back to the Pali version for the full text. Okay. Where are we here? So that's this one here that we've just been looking at. The Sanskrit fragments here. Alright. So that's what I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Bhagga country at Sumsumara Gira in the Behesakala Grove in the Deer Park. So the Sumsumara Gira meaning the hill of the crocodiles. Now, on that occasion, a palace named Kokanada had recently been built for Prince Bodhi. Nada meaning cry or call. Koka, I think, being a heron or something like that. Been built for Prince Bodhi and had not yet been inhabited by any recluse or Brahmin or any human being at all. Prince Bodhi was the son of King Udena of Kosambi. His mother was the daughter of King Chandrapajota of Avanti. And so he's Kosambi being south or a bit west of Savatthi. So then Prince Bodhi addressed the Brahmin student Sanjikaputta, thus, come my dear Sanjikaputta, go to the Blessed One and pay homage in my name with your head at his feet, and ask whether he's free from illness and affliction and is healthy, strong and abiding in comfort. Saying, Venerable Sir, Prince Bodhi pays homage with his head at the Blessed One's feet, and he asks whether the Blessed One is free from illness and abiding in comfort. And then say this, Venerable Sir, that the Blessed One, together with the Sangha of Bhikkhus, consent to accept tomorrow's meal from Prince Bodhi. And then he went to do so. The Buddha consented in silence. And knowing that the Blessed One had consented, Sanjikaputta rose from his seat, went to Prince Bodhi and told him what had happened. And when the night had ended, Prince Bodhi had good food of various kinds prepared, and then had the Kokanada palace spread with white cloth down to the last step of the staircase. Then he addressed the Brahmin student, Sanjikaputta, thus, come, my dear Sanjikaputta, and tell the Blessed One the meal is ready. And it being morning, the Blessed One dressed, taking his bowl and outer robe, went to Prince Bodhi's residence. Now, on that occasion, Prince Bodhi was standing in the outer porch waiting for the Blessed One. When he saw the Blessed One coming in the distance, he went to meet him and paid homage to him, and then, allowing the Blessed One to precede him, he proceeded to the Kokanada Palace. But the Blessed One stopped at the lowest step of the staircase. Prince Bodhi said to him, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One step on the cloth, let the Sublime One step on the cloth, that it may lead to my welfare and happiness for a long time. When this was said, the Blessed One was silent. Second time and a third time, Prince Bodhi said the same thing. And then the Blessed One looked at Venerable Ananda. Venerable Ananda said to Prince Bodhi, Prince, let the cloth be removed. The Blessed One will not step on a strip of cloth that a Tathagata has regard for future generations. So Prince Bodhi had the cloth removed, and he had seats prepared in the upper apartments of the Kokanada Palace. The Blessed One and the Sangha of Bhikkhus ascended the Kokanada Palace and sat down on the seats that had been prepared. So what's all that about? What's going on? He wouldn't step on the white cloth. Well, maybe that's the background. But what is it? We'll look at the background story in a minute. But just looking straight at the text as it is, what do you think is going on? What strikes you as being the likely dynamic here? What's actually happening? Too much pomp.
Because he's not going to do something, just like Prince said, he wanted him to step on it so that it would, what does it say, to lead to
his happiness and welfare.
Wealth and whatever.
Happiness and welfare, yeah.
Yeah.
Benefit.
Benefit for the future.
Mm.
Which is,
the
delusion, self-believing,
walking on the white cloth. I mean, what effect does walking on the
white
cloth have?
Really,
you dirty the cloth.
Well, that's the first point.
Well, maybe indeed the princess has had a very expensive outfit because the Buddha touched it, and then it's like, oh, it's the holy white cloth.
Yeah, yeah.
You can make money.
Yeah, yeah, but that's possible. Yeah. Sell it on eBay, yeah, as trodden by the Buddha. I don't know if Mrs. Bodhi would have been so happy with it, looking at all that cloth that she'd have to wash afterwards.
Well, it strikes me as being a bit like that story you said about the Sonia Gandhi, or the president of India, and they're putting out 20 kilometres of cloth all the way.
Yeah.
It's just like over the top, extravagant.
Yeah.
And the Buddha said, sorry, guys.
Can we leave that aside for now? We'll come to that in a minute, but I want to hear people's response to this actual text. We'll come to the commentarial interpretation in a minute, but I just want to hear what exactly how do you feel about, like, how do you actually respond to this?
Well, I agree with you, but I wouldn't have walked on quietly.
There's nothing wrong with that. He just wants to do something good because he recognizes that the trouble.
His motivation is
that's all right. What's wrong with that? You're trying to do something so you'll be happy in the future. Nothing wrong with that.
Fortune telling or something, proper sensing or something for the sake of ladies or happiness, but that's not the function of the samba.
So you think it's more like a kind of a magical kind of ritual kind of thingy?
It's a very ritualistic thing. When he says about the future generation, he's probably referring to future generations of samba.
Yeah, which of course is exactly what the Sankhya does. But
and cloth was very. I mean, as you sort of say, we hear lots of times, and cloth was actually very costly in those days. So to put white cloth all the way up the stairs of the palace.
I don't know, gold balls. Some good taka, yeah.
I mean, you have to eat, but you don't have to step on it.
We've got two distinct interpretations here. One is the magico-superstitious interpretation. The other is the luxury interpretation. Okay, so that's two. Any other suggestions? Any other thoughts?
I thought the Buddha was really cool. That he didn't just go along with
whatever lay people want him to do. Yeah. He actually kind of just knows what he should have done and he just refused to do it. Mm-hmm. The white cloth has cultural implications that the Buddha would be aware of.
Yeah, definitely has strong cultural implications, yeah. You remember in the first council that actually one of the things that Ananda was criticized for was for stepping on the Buddha's bathing cloth, which is kind of interesting, isn't it? Yeah, but definitely cloth had a strong implication. As Annie said, I mean, cloth was more valuable then than it is now, but I'm not sure that for a prince that putting out some cloth for someone to walk on would be that extravagant. I mean, yeah, it's a luxury thing in a way, but it's not.
The Buddha was guiding people out of these rites and rituals, to the essence of the Dharma. So this kind of thing would fall under the category meaningless rites and rituals.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's interesting how it's put at the end there. The Pachimang Janatang Tathagata Anakampati. The Tathagata, literally the Tathagata has compassion for the later generations or for the people who come afterwards. And of course it's not exactly explained, but either explanation, either the luxury explanation or the ritual explanation would work with that. Mm-hmm. Either the Buddha didn't want the Sangha to fall into luxurious ways and so on. And certainly we find there's plenty of passages where that's the case, but also could be the case that he didn't want the Sangha to get... It would be compassion for both the lay people for having their kind of the expectations and the wrong views that could grow up around that, but also compassion for the Sangha for not having to do all of the rituals which end up having to do so much of the time. And of course these kinds of things you find are in fact very, very customary in throughout Buddhist cultures. But just to come now to the commentarial story, just to see how the traditions have dealt with this. The commentary, Pali commentary, explains that Prince Bodhi was childless and desired a son. He had heard that people can fulfill their wishes by making special offerings to the Buddha, so he spread the white cloth with the idea, if I am to have a son, the Buddha will step on the cloth. If I am not to have a son, he will not step on the cloth. The Buddha knew that by reason of past evil karma, Prince Bodhi and his wife were destined to remain childless. Hence, he did not step on the cloth. Later, he laid down a disciplinary rule prohibiting the bhikkhus from stepping on a white cloth. So this is in the Vinaya version of the text. But subsequently modified the rule to allow bhikkhus to step on a cloth as a blessing for householders. Right?
So that goes right from ritual.
Exactly. Exactly. So kind of interesting there. I mean, obviously the commentary has, you know, got this whole kind of background story. You know, we've got this childless couple. You've got this kind of human pathos thing. Prince wants to have an heir, and so on and so forth. And so that's all fairly kind of stock, kind of storytelling motifs. It kind of feels to me that's not an implausible scenario. But it kind of feels to me that it's been a bit overdetermined, and that just from the text itself, it's probably more likely that it was just seen as being an auspicious thing for the Buddha to walk on it. I mean, that's what he says, it's for my happiness and benefit in the future. So it seems that, you know, very often when people are seeking blessings and benefits of various kinds, it's just a very general thing. I mean, the occasion is the completion of the hall, and it's very normal to invite the Sangha, and the Buddha did this on many occasions, to go and use the hall to be the first one to use it. So that was felt to be auspicious, and it wasn't felt to be anything wrong with doing that. But then this thing with the cloth, it seems to me most likely it was felt, as just the text says, like a general thing of being an auspicious thing to do. Whether the story with the son and so on should be taken literally, I'm not sure. Yeah, well, just have a quick look at some of that. I think that comes up. I think Analia gives the actual textual references here, so we can just check that exactly. Now the commentary.
Sorry.
Yep. No, the Buddha didn't know the future. That's what it says in the commentary, yeah. As I say, I don't know how seriously to take that.
The commentary might have known you as childless, because...
Exactly. Generally speaking, no. Yeah, generally speaking. Although, I mean, theoretically, one might imagine that particular kind of knowledge of the future that he might be able to do, in the sense that he's seeing like a particular consequence of a particular act, okay? And any one of us can see the future in that kind of sense, right? So if somebody thinks, I'm going to walk to Sydney and get there by evening, well, I can see the future and I know that they're not going to get there by evening, okay? Because I know the cause and effect. Right. And so in a sense, this is knowing the future in that kind of limited and specific way, if you can really tell the person's karma. But again, the karma is what, sorry? Except for him. Yeah.
Maybe the Buddha was just very good at ecological thinking.
Uh-huh.
That it's not worth waiting on that.
Well, that's the environmental interpretation. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's another one. So, compassion for later generations. So we've now, I submitted the household duties explanation. So now we've got four. One is that he thought it was too luxurious. Two is that he didn't want to do the ritual. Three is he wanted to spare the missus from having to do the laundry. And four is he didn't want to.
that happiness, we achieve happiness through our inner work, not through our physical sense. Is it given a wrong message that maybe you put a piece of love when you are 10 years of that?
Yeah.
In our inner work?
Yeah, well, that would be the kind of the ritual superstitious kind of idea, yeah, that you're doing this. I mean, these things are just absolutely endemic through most cultures, you know, that these kinds of things. So.
What about when the texts say the Buddha is sort of like all seeing? Mm-hmm. What does it actually refer to?
In which context?
There's quite a few times in the sutras that the Buddha was kind of referred to as omniscient and all seeing. Does it mean like, you know, I thought it could be like you can see the past and future.
Yeah, that's how it's often interpreted, but the Buddha's own claims for it are much more limited. So these things always have a kind of context.
Well, Buddha doesn't say anything, he doesn't say anything for the end of the year. It's actually impossible to know why he's
speaking. When the phrases knower of all and things like that, they don't mean literal omniscience in the sense that literally knowing everything all the time. The Buddha explicitly said that he didn't have that kind of ability, said it's impossible. But also remember that all, the word all, is very commonly used to refer to the six senses and what's knowable through the six senses. So when he says he's the knower of all, then that's what he means, is he's knower of whatever's knowable through the six senses. Because that's what the world is made out of.
So, did he actually explicitly explain what does he mean by that? What authority he actually has?
That's addressed in a number of suttas, in the Majjhima Nikaya and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a good essay by Analeo on the Buddha and omniscience. Mm-hmm. So, if you want to have a look at that, yeah.
And there's also a sense of all meaning all that you need to know. So there's some sutras where you say, you know, if you know this, you know all. That seems to me. If you know this, you know what you need to know in order to get enlightened.
Mm. Mm. Something like that. Yeah.
What about the sutra where he talks about what will happen in the future, and then because we have children in 5 years?
Well, that whole sutra is put in an entirely mythical framework. You know, it's talking about things which happened, you know, it's obviously not a kind of literal historical time frame. You can't interpret that too literally. Yeah, I mean, that particular sutta uses, for example, there's an interesting essay by Richard Gombrich on that, and he shows how he uses a lot of the cliches and ideas from Brahmanical creation mythology and things like that, and then sort of twists it and gives it a kind of ironical spin. So it's quite a playful kind of text actually in its context. It's never meant to be taken too literally. The Chakravarti Sihanada Sutta and the Agami Sutta.
Mm-hmm.
Here in the car. 29 and 30. Diga. 29 and something. Alright, here we go. According blah blah blah, blah looked at future generations. What are you looked at future generations? The Tathagata. Apaloketi. Ah, interesting. Anukampati. So interestingly, when it says that he has compassion for later generations. And there's actually different readings in the Pali. Some Pali editions, the Sri Lankan editions, have apaloketi, which means to look at or to look down on. Apaloketi being similar to the meaning of avalokiteshvara. But the Burmese edition has anukampati, has compassion for future generations, as also in the commentary has compassion. And the text that we're using here, where are we? The text we're using here, being primarily a Burmese text, has anukampati. So that's an interesting little textual variation there. Having regard for, which would be reading an apaloketi. Yeah, apaloketi, having regard for, yeah. I was wondering why he translated it that way when I saw the anukampati. But that's fairly common phrase to have compassion for future generations. So interesting that there's a variation there. So where are we? So the Pali Vinaya speaks of his compassion for future generations, and the Chinese Vinaya of his compassion for the world. The Mahijasika Vinaya. The commentary explains that at the Buddha's time, many monks had supernormal powers and were able to find out if someone was destined to remain childless. Of course, this being this whole theme of the childlessness relating to one of the great themes of ancient religions, which was the notion of fertility, and the idea that religious practices were there in order to promote fertility. Based on such knowledge, they were able to decide if it was opportune to step on a cloth on such occasions. So the monks who knew what they were on about, they would know whether to step on the cloth or not. In later times, however, monks who do not have such supernormal powers and might not know if it was opportune to step on a cloth in similar circumstances. If they should step on a cloth and then the couple were to remain childless, this would cause people to look down on the monks. So they'd know who's got the real business and who doesn't. In order to prevent this from happening, out of compassion, the Buddha remained silent. And so according to Venerable Anario, this commentarial explanation, so kind of interesting kind of to notice the modern edition's perspectives, because that particular aspect of what's in the commentary is not mentioned by Bhikkhu Bodhi in his note. Yeah, so Bhikkhu Bodhi in his footnotes gives a summary of the commentary. And of course Bhikkhu Bodhi, especially at the time when he was writing the Majjhima, was kind of concerned to, or generally to depict the commentaries in a favourable light. And so he sort of printed or presented the commentarial explanation in a way that makes it sound more reasonable. And Alio is pointing out more fully what's actually in there. This commentarial explanation does not really help to explain the situation, according to Venerable Anario. If the Buddha knew that Prince Bodhi was to remain childless, it would seem sufficient for not stepping on the cloth without any need to have concern or compassion for future generations. So, but, I mean, it seems very convoluted and unnecessary kind of explanation for the whole thing. But what that does show, the very fact that it's developed a convoluted explanation, shows that there was a discussion and a dialogue and a question in the early community as to what this passage actually did mean. Though according to the Pali Vinaya, the Buddha took the present instance as the occasion to promulgate a rule against stepping on cloth, that same rule was soon enough abolished again. This suggests that the problem of future monks who might be able to unable to decide if stepping on a cloth will accord with what lies in store for a childless couple was not too pressing a concern for the Buddha. Yes, one might consider that it's probably wasn't a concern at all for the Buddha.
I think the next bit is probably the most likely and plausible.
Next, okay, so the Mahijasika Vinaya in fact differs from the Pali Vinaya account as it does not relate the present event to a regulation about stepping on cloth. According to the Mahijasika Vinaya, the problem that arose was rather that the monks made a mess when partaking of the food offered by Prince Bodhi. This behaviour caused the laity to criticise the monks and led the Buddha to lay down a regulation that food should be received and partaken of in a proper manner. Now, what I would like to say right at this point is I believe that this definitively proves that my laundry suggestion is actually the right one. And if we combine the two accounts, the problem is spilling food on white cloth. And you know what that turmeric does when it gets into the cloth.
Because the original vinegar was actually no use to getting bolognese.
Yeah. So interesting. So we've got these two. So the story, two completely different accounts of what's happened. Then the story how Prince Bodhi wanted the Buddha to step on a cloth recurs also in the Dhammapada commentary. The Dhammapada commentary continues by reporting that Prince Bodhi asked the Buddha why he did not step on the cloth. The Buddha explained to Prince Bodhi that Prince Bodhi was destined to remain childless and gave an account of Prince Bodhi's former unwholesome deeds that were responsible for his present childlessness. It doesn't say what he actually did. the evil deed Prince Bodhi, oh, here we go, had done in a former life was that he and his wife survived on eggs and birds after being shipwrecked, not feeling any remorse at killing living beings. Ah. The Dhammapada commentary concludes this account with a verse by the Buddha on the need to protect oneself and to remain wakeful during the three watches of the night.
So you don't get shipwrecked.
Right, to remain wakeful during the three watches of the night. Well, right. In relation to this account, it may seem that the story of Prince Bodhi's former deeds does not fit too well with an injunction to remain vigilant during the three watches of the night. Such an injunction would better fit the practice of meditation undertaken by monks and nuns during the early and late hours of the night, not to the life of a prince or a shipwreck. Now then, the Chinese, to continue the development of the different things, the Chinese Dharmapada Avadana embeds its version of this verse into a different story. Okay, so you've got the same verse, right, which is to be vigilant during three watches of the night. It doesn't have anything to do with Prince Bodhi, but it's given the background story of Prince Bodhi. Okay, now another version of this verse is found in this other text, Dharmapada Avadana. The same verse, a completely different background story, describing a monk on the verge of suicide out of desperation at his inability to learn the Dhamma. Such a situation would fit with an injunction to protect oneself and to be wakeful during the nights, indicating to the monk that instead of committing suicide, he should rather make an effort at practicing meditation. And now, I think that's very good advice, personally. The Chinese Dhammapada Avadana account concludes by reporting that, stirred by the Buddha's intervention, this monk soon became an arahant. Okay? So, in summary, there was a bunch of suicidal monks eating fish and eggs, which they spilled onto the cloth. They felt so depressed about it that they wanted to commit suicide. Okay? Prince Bodhi thought, let me just cover this all up with a piece of cloth. So that's why I get out of this, all right? So anyway, we can see from all of these accounts how this kind of literature evolves and develops. And that the different sections are connected with each other based on sometimes plausible, sometimes less plausible grounds. Different traditions will combine it and explain it in different kinds of ways. And also occurs as background story for different rules. So, and of course, you'll find that this thing about the cloth, even though I've certainly been in places where they have the cloth on the ground. And people, you know, you are supposed to step on it and so on. The procedure of the rule, the Buddha disallowed it and then allowed it again later. I would think most likely the reallowing of it later was simply the practice in the Sangha changed in later years, and it was sort of back read into the Vinaya to make it allowable, because it was difficult for monks to just keep saying no, they're not going to step on the white cloth. But certainly it's standard in Sri Lankan houses that you'll sit, as you sit on, they put white cloth on the chair before you sit on it, and in some places you will have a strip of cloth to walk on as well. So then, with his own hands, Prince Bodhi served and satisfied the Sangha. Oh, and I should mention actually that if we compare the Vinaya and the Sutta here, the Sutta just has the Buddha not stepping on a strip of cloth because of compassion for future generations, right? So what we have here in the Sutta is simply a precedent. There's a certain act that the Buddha did or didn't do in this case. Now the Vinaya then codifies that as a rule, okay? It then becomes a rule that you can't do that. But then, having codified it, it then undoes it and says, well, you can do it if it's just out of consideration for the lay people. So that whole process of development, as usual, or as I would say is quite normal, shows that the Vinaya is going several stages of development further than what we find in the suttas. And so I would think that the suttas here actually represent the original tradition, that simply the Buddha refused to step on a strip of cloth for his own reasons. And that later it was made a rule that you can't do that, but then probably many generations later again, that rule was basically undone.
the original rule wasn't formulated by the Buddha?
Oh, it's quite possible, quite likely, yeah. Okay. So, had the Kothramurti had seats prepared in the upper apartments of the Kokanada Palace, the Blessed One and Sangha bhikkhus ascended, sat down on the seats. When the Blessed One had eaten and put his bowl aside, Prince Bodhi took a low seat, sat down at one side, and said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, we have thought thus. Pleasure is not to be gained through pleasure. Pleasure is to be gained through pain." Okay. Is the Pali here? Na ko sukena sukhang adhigantabhang, dukena ko sukhang adhigantabhanti. Pleasure is not to be gained through pleasure, pleasure is to be gained through pain. Now, as Bhikkhu Bodhi notes in the footnotes here, that elsewhere in the Pali canon, this particular tenet is attributed to the Jains, and in the Chula Dukkha Kanda Sutta, Majjhima 14, the Jain ascetics say to the Buddha, "Friend Gotama, pleasure is not to be gained through pleasure, pleasure is to be gained through pain. For were pleasure to be gained through pleasure, then King Senya Bindisara of Magadha would gain pleasure, since he abides in greater pleasure than Venerable Gotama." So this is the doctrine attributed to the Jains. And certainly similar in some ways to the genuine Jaina doctrine. Whether it's identical with it is probably a matter for research. In any case, the Buddha here responds, "Prince, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too thought thus, pleasure is not to be gained through pleasure, pleasure is to be gained through pain." So this is a very, very important statement. And this is in terms of Buddhist teachings, this is probably the most significant phrase in the whole sutta. And this is something which has come up repeatedly in our discussions in recent weeks, starting with the Gatikara Sutta. And of course the Buddha describing himself as anabhisambuddhasa bodhisattvasa. Okay, while I was not fully enlightened bodhisattva, he had this wrong view. So, and this is of course a Jaina view, or at least attributed to the Jainas. So this of course being one of the very clear passages where the nature and the beliefs of the bodhisattva, of Siddhartha as a young man, are quite different from what is attributed to him in the later traditions. Okay, so clearly from this point of view, he didn't understand the spiritual path. He had a wrong view and a wrong idea about practice. And of course he's giving a perfectly sensible explanation for why he did all of the ascetic practices before he got enlightened. Precisely because he had the wrong view that by practicing in this way, as James did, then he would realize enlightenment. Now, all through the Buddhist scriptures, it's the way the Buddha's practice in that period of doing ascetic practices is identical with the way that the Jains are described, and so it's very likely he was either a Jaina monk or at least in a group very closely associated with them. And so this is again very consonant with this idea that he wasn't destined to become enlightened from the moment of his birth or anything like that, or whether he'd made these determinations in past lives and all of these kinds of things. The picture we get from especially the Majjhima Nikaya is that he left home and he was seeking and trying to find the way, and he didn't know. And the reason why he took so long, or took 6 years to find the path, was because he really just didn't understand what he was doing and didn't understand how the path of practice should be developed.
That doesn't mean that he wasn't distant. I mean, the fact that he doesn't
Because
if you're destined to do something, it doesn't mean that you were born with it. It just means that at a certain period in your life, you get there. That's what it means to be just destined to be enlightened. The fact that you're not born enlightened doesn't mean that somebody comes and you're born, but that's what you get to do.
Sure, I understand that. But the tradition's claims are somewhat stronger than that.
Mm-hmm.
So the tradition's claims are that he sees things like consciously developing a path of spiritual practice and has known and understood how to get enlightened for so many lifetimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so clearly from these kind of passages he didn't. You know, he was experimenting.
Perspective that actually is an uncontestable perspective when you talk about destiny in that way, because no matter what you say against that kind of understanding of destiny, you just say, oh, well, that was destined.
Yeah, I'm not saying that it's true, I'm just saying that the people who claim that it was a destiny, this will not convince them.
Yeah,
because
but that's because
that's what I'm saying.
That's because they hold a view that is uncontestable.
Yeah. So it's not necessarily a matter of convincing people, but just a matter of trying to explore what the texts mean.
What about that episode about he throw the ball into the river and go upwards?
Yeah.
I don't know where it is in the
kind. That's part of the later legends. Yeah.
That's not part of the.
Because
people was like saying, you know, in Dharma talk, saying that, you know, this is how the Buddha know, oh, this is my path, you could go against the stream, and they even have the Pali word for it, and things like that.
Yeah, I think actually the Pali word is in this sutra, if I'm not wrong. Yeah, he did use that word, Patisotagami, but the actual event is.
It's nothing to do with throwing the ball in the river and mysteriously go upstream?
No, unfortunately.
Yeah, that was a great irony on that article. Because it was written by a man trying to show the relevance of radicalism, but he used conservative. What's the word when you make legends in history? He used a legend to justify.
I know that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was looking for that word in the.
Hagiography.
Yeah. So, okay, so then the Buddha goes on to tell his story of his striving, and this is here abbreviated largely from the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, Majjhima 26, and the Mahasatchika Sutta, Majjhima 36. So we've already been over those particular suttas, so we won't go over these passages in too much detail, but obviously... This includes that whole path of developing the jhanas and so on, remembering his practice of jhana as a young man, young boy, and then developing the jhanas and so on, and then this idea that the pleasant and painful feeling didn't invade his mind and remain, which is from the Mahasatchika Sutta, so that the teaching there relates to this idea of pleasure and pain, which we've had previously brought up by Bodhiraja Kumara. And then it doesn't occur. Oh, sorry, yes, thank you for that. I missed that. Okay, so so in that case it's distinguished from, oh, that's interesting. I wonder how he knows that. It's actually spelled out in full in certain texts and abbreviated in other texts. Thank you for noticing that, Jim. In the Sanskrit version, interestingly enough, it says, Sanskrit version, it says that the Sanskrit fragment does not present this account in full, but indicated that it should be supplemented from the preceding discourse, the Kaya Bhavana Sutra, parallel to the Majjhima 36, the Mahasatchika Sutta. So it's the development of the Bodhi Sutra. And so this is actually the Sanskrit phrase is Vistarena Yata Kaya Bhavana Sutre. So it's actually giving an explicit thing, saying all should be told in full, just as it is in the Mahasatchika Sutta. So if that was the case, if it was actually expanded according to the Kaya Bhavana Sutra, then it would include that phrase about the pleasure and pain not invading your mind and remain. So there seems to be some ambiguity there in the tradition about whether that should be there or not. That reminds me, when we were talking about the Sanskrit Sutta before, I missed out one of the things I was going to mention there, is the reason why this particular sutta, the Bodhiraja Kumara Sutta, and also the Mahasatchika Sutta, Kaya Bhavana Sutta, are not found in the Majjhima Nikaya, even though they're somewhat important suttas. Not that they're not found in the Majjhima Nikaya. Why are they not found in the Majjhima Agama in Chinese translation, and why are they not found in the Chinese Agamas at all? The point here is that these suttas were in the Sanskrit, in the Sarvastivadin tradition, were found in the Dirga Agama rather than the Majjhima Agama. But the Sanskrit version, the Sarvastivadin version of the Dirga Agama was never translated, but the Majjhima version was. So the Sanskrit, the Sarvastivadins put these suttas in their Diga, but that wasn't translated into Chinese. The Dharmaguptakas presumably had versions of this in their Majjhima, but their Diga was translated, not the Majjhima. So these suttas somehow fell down between the cracks. So it's interesting to know about how to make inferences about these things, is we always have to be cautious. Now, the fact that these suttas are not found in the Chinese texts would incline us to suggest that they were perhaps less important suttas, that perhaps they were a later development. Okay? But in fact, what's happened is that Sarvastivadins have taken them out of the Majjhima and put them in the Diga. What that suggests is that they actually thought that they were more important, because the Diga has less suttas, and that tends to be the longer and more important suttas in the Diga. So rather than minimizing their importance, it's actually maximizing it, if anything. Where are we now? So then the bhikkhus of the group of five, not long after being thus taught and instructed by me, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge here and now, entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the former into homelessness. So this being the conclusion of the abbreviated passage. Then it went on. Prince Bodhi said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, when a bhikkhu finds the Tathagata to discipline him, how long is it, by realizing for himself, with direct knowledge, he here and now enters it upon and abides in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness? As to that, Prince, I shall ask you a question in return. Answer it as you choose. What do you think, Prince? Are you skilled in the art of wielding a goad while riding an elephant?" Obviously being something which a prince should be able to do. And so he says, "Yes, Venerable Sir, I am. What do you think, Prince? Suppose a man came here thinking, 'Prince Bodhi knows the art of wielding a goad while riding an elephant. I shall train in that art under him.' If he had no faith, he could not achieve what can be achieved by one who has faith. If he had much illness, he could not achieve what can be achieved by one who is free from illness. If he was fraudulent and deceitful, he could not achieve what is to be achieved by one who is honest and sincere. If he was lazy, then he couldn't achieve what was to be achieved by one who is energetic. If he was not wise, he could not achieve by what is to be achieved by one who is wise. What do you think, Prince? Could that man train under you in the art of wielding a goad while riding an elephant? Venerable Sir, even if he had one of those deficiencies, he could not train under me. So what of the five?" Buddha goes on to ask the questions again in reverse. What do you think if a man comes and he does have those qualities of faith, health, honesty, energetic and wisdom, then could that man train under you in the art of wielding a goad while riding an elephant? And he says, "Of course, if he had one of those qualities, he could train under me. So what of the five?" So too, Prince. Mildly, this is Indian logic, okay? We're trapped in these Aristotelian, explorer of excluded middle linear thinking here. Sorry?
He said he was missing one of the five. He couldn't do it.
I think Kim, you need to explain about the fallacies of Aristotelian logic.
Can you explain?
Which one? What does it mean?
The logic.
And what's the logic?
Well,
Paul, for example, let's say just take one of the illness. I mean, if you believe that only illness and non-illness exists,
mm-hmm.
i.e. if you've got a dualist, you know, this is my personal, I mean, I've never studied philosophy, if you believe that only illness and non-illness exist, then obviously this wouldn't work, this type of thing. But if there's a...
Right, so if you're Aristotelian law of excluded middle, right, that's what it is.
So the person who doesn't have, you know, fantastic health, might be good enough, though. But he mightn't be sick, but he could be just good enough.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but he might just excel in wisdom and everything else is, you know, okay.
Yeah.
But he's not deceitful, he's not sick, etc., etc. And we're all like that, as far as I can see.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And we're all actually, you know.
Somewhere in the middle.
So look, I think that's a very, very good explanation. I think it's basically it's just an idiomatic kind of, you know, way of putting it. I wouldn't try to take it too literally, but I think that's a pretty good way of putting it.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. So two prints here. So notice that the Buddha doesn't actually directly answer the question. Okay. So the question up here. He says, how long is it till he can get enlightened? Okay, and the Buddha then goes on to ask this question about training elephants and so on. And there's a very classic phrase, unforgettable phrase in this book. I can't remember the name of the book now. It's called Karma and Its Results or something by this modern Thai monk. It came out a few years ago. And one of the most memorable passages there was when he was in the monastery and some monk wanted to teach him the elephant training knowledge. So here he is, he's in the monastery, this monk wants to teach him how to train elephants, and he's like, what do I want to learn about training elephants for? You know, and this monk says, oh, you should learn it, and he says, oh, I don't know, why am I a monk, why am I learning how to train elephants? So he goes to see the abbot, and the abbot says, learn it, son, it'll come in useful later on. So he says, and it did come in useful later on. I was trying to teach this nun last rains retreat, and it really came in useful. So that would be... So these things, you never know quite how they come out. Venerable sir, if he has one of these qualities, he could train under me, so what of the five? And the Buddha said, so too, Prince. There are these five padhaniyangani, five factors of striving. What five? Here, a bhikkhu has faith. He places his faith in the Tathagata's enlightenment. Thus, that blessed one is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. Of course, this being the Itipiso formula. And he is free from illness and affliction, possessing a good digestion that is neither too cool nor too warm, but medium and able to bear the strain of striving. Yeah. Yep. Thank you very much. Then he is honest and sincere and shows himself as he actually is to the teacher and to his companions in the holy life. So he's asato hoti amayavi. So he's not a practitioner, an illusionist, literally. So David Copperfield wouldn't make it. Then he is energetic in abandoning unwholesome dhammas and in undertaking wholesome dhammas, steadfast, launching his effort with firmness and persevering in cultivating wholesome states. And then he is wise. He possesses wisdom regarding the rise and disappearance, that is noble and penetrative, and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. These are the five factors of striving. So this is a standard definition of the kind of the noble wisdom, or wisdom in the sense of understanding impermanence, rise and fall, conditionality, etc. And at its kind of when that's ripe, or the perfect or at least when that's fully established or well established, is the wisdom of a stream enterer. These are the five factors of striving. The Buddha goes on. Prince, when a bhikkhu possesses these five factors of striving, finds a Tathagata to discipline him, he might dwell 7 years until he attains arahantship, let alone 7 years, 5 years, 6 years, 5 years, 4, 3, 2, 1 year, 7 months, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 month, half a month, 7 days and nights, 6 days and nights, 5 days and nights, 4 days and nights, 3 days and nights, 2 days and nights, or 1 day and night. Let alone 1 day and night, Prince, when a bhikkhu who possesses these five factors of striving finds a Tathagata to discipline him, then being instructed in the evening, he might arrive at distinction in the morning, or being instructed in the morning, he might arrive at distinction in the evening. So here the Buddha kind of sets it up, saying that this is the kind of question which can't be answered directly. So remember that the Buddha said there are various kinds of questions which need to be answered in various kinds of ways. Some of them you can give a direct answer to, some of which need to be answered by a counter question, some of which need to be answered by analysis. And this particular question, particular case, he couldn't directly answer the question, how long does it take to get enlightened, because it depends on the qualities of the person who's practicing. But someone who's ideal, who has all of the qualities and applies themselves with the utmost diligence, can be enlightened even that same day. And of course this passage is similar to a much more famous passage found in the Satipatthana Sutta. And the proponents of the Vipassanavada, and those who like to claim that the Satipatthana Sutta is somehow a kind of special, extraordinary sutta and so on, often suggest, or seems to be the idea, that because that sutta is very well known and the Buddha's kind of promise or guarantee of enlightenment at the end of the Satipatthana Sutta is taken as being an indication that the Satipatthana method of practice is somehow especially effective and guaranteed because of that. And as so often or as usual, that idea only comes because of unfamiliarity with the suttas, and it merely arises because the Satipatthana Sutta is more well known than other places, and this particular sutta mentions nothing about Satipatthana, and yet we get to practice not to get enlightened just in 7 days, which the Satipatthana Sutta recommends, but we can even do it on the same day. So there you go, it's even better. It would be Vinaya. I'm just trying to find the exact phrase. Yeah. Vinayakam. Okay, yeah, so Pradhanismanagato. So any bhikkhu, so endowed with these five factors, any bhikkhu who gains the Tathagata as a Vinayaka, or literally as a Vinaya-er, is what Vinayaka means. So, Sayangvi Sesang Adhigamisati, not 100% explicit, but that seems to be the implication, yeah. Certainly up above it's explicitly talking about arahantship, but that the phrase, the distinction by itself, doesn't necessarily mean arahantship, but seems to imply it in the context. So, when this was said, Prince Bodhi said to the blessed... Oh, I should actually just come back to Anadio's thing here. He has a bit of discussion. The Pali version, the Buddha gave the example of Prince Bodhi teaching someone how to ride an elephant. According to the Sanskrit fragments, the Buddha also brought up other abilities to be taught by Prince Bodhi, such as horse riding, driving a chariot, fencing and archery, as well as writing and calculation. And so in a sense, this is an example of the Buddha's skill in teaching according to people's particular situation. He was raising all of these skills which a prince was supposed to learn. Now, to bring in several crafts fits the context well, since of such variety illustrates that the task of leading a monk to liberation requires training in various abilities encompassing such issues as proper conduct, concentration and insight. A prince would indeed need to be capable not only at riding an elephant, but also riding a horse, driving a chariot, fencing and archery. So it would be natural in the present context to envisage him teaching such activities. In the case of calculation and writing, the situation appears less straightforward. Other Pali passages indicate that that calculation was a specific profession in ancient India, yet one could nevertheless assume some basic training in this art to behove a future ruler. Okay, so whether the kings were actually taught accounting, possibly not. According to the Lalita Vistara, even the art of writing formed part of the curriculum of the Bodhisattva as a prince. This passage, however, lists types of writing that appear to belong to the realm of fantasy. And he lists them down here. This passage in the Lalita Vistara includes, among others, the scripts of the Devas, the Nagas, the Yakas, the Gandhabas, the Asuras, and the Garudas. Scripts which are absent from a comparable list of Indian scriptures found in the Mahavastu. The whole episode in the Lalita Vistara is pervaded by a strong tendency to enhance the marvellous virtues of the Bodhisattva, and thus is far from being a reliable representation of an ancient Indian prince's curriculum. Fair enough. Lalita Vistara is an extremely important text. This is the Buddha biography, the hagiography, closely associated with the Sarvastivadin school, and which became standard in a lot of northern India, was one of the best known texts, and you find that the Lalita Vistara forms the basis for a lot of Buddhist popular culture and the ideas that that's found in artworks and so on, Borobudur and many other places, all based on the Lalita Vistara. Historical evidence suggests that at the time of the Buddha, writing may not yet have been in existence. Okay, now that's contestable, and it's a bit controversial. Analio gives some footnotes here to Mark Allen in 1997, notes that neither Pali discourses nor the Vinaya refer to writing materials, and there's no archaeological evidence for the use of writing in India at the time of the Buddha. In Huber in 1989, based on examining occurrences of lickety literally meaning to scratch, okay, and being the normal Indian word for writing, this being related to the old Indic lekha, a word from lickety in Pali. Hinuba, based on examining occurrences of lickety and related terms in Pali discourses and the Vinaya, suggests it to refer mainly to drawing, and concludes that there's no evidence for the use of writing before the 3rd century BC. Now this, I'm not convinced by these academic arguments. The more mainstream academic position was established by Rhys Davids more than 100 years ago, which was that writing existed and is referred to occasionally in the suttas and the Vinaya, and but it was never used for religious purposes. Okay. Now that's been the mainstream understanding of Western scholarship for 100 years or so. Now these scholars are contesting that. Now perhaps the situation is not quite as clear-cut as Rhys David's made out, but I certainly don't think it's also clear-cut that they don't refer, these instances don't refer to writing. But also, I believe that this statement here, referring to work of Mark Allen in 1997, I believe that's incorrect and may have been outdated since that time. And I believe that there is now archaeological evidence for the use of writing in Sri Lanka back to the time of the Buddha. And I believe there's also a few just bits of pottery and so on found on mainland India. So I think there is now archaeological evidence, probably back to around the time of the Buddha, of the use of writing in India. However, that doesn't actually change the situation all that much. There was certainly no major usage of writing for religious purposes in the time of the Buddha. And the first kind of really significant writing in ancient India is definitely the Ashokan inscriptions. There's no doubt about that. Yeah, it's not long after. It's maybe 150 years or so. Yeah. It's not to develop it to such an extent, yeah. But it's hard because the Ashokan pillars and edicts are so completely unprecedented in every way. You know, it's not just the fact that the writing on them is unprecedented, but there's no stonemason, there's no stonework in ancient India before the Ashokan pillars. There's nothing. There's not one single piece of carved, you know, a carved rock that's remotely comparable in ancient India, and then suddenly you get these absolutely perfect magnificent monuments, which 2,500 years later are still among the ancient world's most outstanding works of stonemasonry. They still got the polish and the shrine.
He imported some Greeks.
No, he imported Persians. So Persians did it, yeah. They bought Persian craftsmen, and they mined it near Benares, was where they got the rock from. But still, even the idea of doing it, you know, I mean, you know, it's a huge.
Some other companies he's done, and he's been there because he's been there.
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah. So sure, I'm just making the point that it's not just the writing which was so unprecedented. Mm-hmm. So the fact that, you know, he could have done the same thing with the writing is just introduced that. Mm-hmm. From somewhere else. But I think it's more likely that the Brahmi scripture, and it does say, as I said, I believe that there are now a few scraps of pottery dating from probably the time of the Buddha, so it was probably around, but not so common. Probably originally used for, the original usage of writing was probably for trade, and for you'd send off a caravan making inventories. We were talking about this the other day, that actually in Mesopotamia you have these huge libraries of clay tablets which have thousands and thousands and thousands of these clay tablets, and you think, you know, you're going to get access to the wisdom of the ancient world and all of these interesting things, and it's actually on January the 13th 2057 BC was sent out a caravan. There were 13 donkeys, 15 jars of wheat, 4 jars of honey, 15 jars of oil, 5 bales of goat's wool, and on and on and on it goes. And these things fill up the libraries in places. Yeah. What was that saying?
It wouldn't call itself BC, would
it? I was being a little bit facetious there. So that's probably how writing was first used in India as well, and obviously that if it's written on palm leaves as opposed to the clay tablets they used in Mesopotamia, then obviously the material didn't last. Okay. So Venerable Nanalo comments on this logical problem that we've already discussed. Okay, so slight differences in the formulation here in the Pali version. The first quality of faith. He is describing the monk's confidence in the awakening of the Tathagata. As we've seen, the Sanskrit instead speaks of a noble disciple whose faith is firmly established so that it cannot be shaken by anyone in the world. In other Pali discourses, such unshakable faith refers to those who've reached stream entry. This suggests that the Sanskrit version to be the less probable reading, according to Venerable Nanalo, since it would make a fruit of practicing the path become a requirement for being taught the path. The Pali and Sanskrit versions agree on defining the quality of being energetic to be a steadfast effort to develop what is wholesome. To this, the Sanskrit fragment adds the determination to not slacken in energy even if the flesh and blood of the body should dry up and only skin, sinews and bones remain.
That's pretty difficult to be energetic in most
of them. The Pali version continues with the Buddha specifying within what time period a disciple may reach realization, a time period ranging from 7 years to at most a single day and night. Although the corresponding part has been completely preserved from the Sanskrit fragment, instead of listing various time periods, it merely records the Buddha indicating that realization can be reached quickly. Perhaps more reasonable kind of reading. The Pali Bodhirajakumara Sutta proclamation that gradual training can lead to realization within a single day and night stands out for being the only instance in the Pali Nikayas to envisage such a short time period. And in the Satipatthana Suttas, as we mentioned before, it says it's a minimum of 7 days. So possibly here we're seeing a similar kind of process, evolutionary process. Quite possibly the earliest text may have just said quickly, and then that was developed into this more elaborate formula. The Pali. Okay, so then we go on to the taking of refuge. Okay, the Pali. Oh, sorry. When this was said, the Brahmin student Sanjay Kaputta said to Prince Bodhi, "Master Bodhi says, 'Oh, the Buddha, oh, the Dhamma, oh, how well proclaimed! is the Dhamma, but he does not say, I go to the Master Gotama for refuge and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of bhikkhus. Do not say that. And so this is the Prince Bodhi saying, Naheva Mavacha. Do not say that, my dear Sanjay Kaputta, do not say that. I heard and learnt this from my mother's lips. Okay, so notice this use of this idiom, and we discussed this some time ago as well, that the use of we have the use in the Pali of the Evam Me Sutang idiom at the beginning of each sutta. And I've said that Evam Me Sutang specifically means, I was not there, but I have it on hearsay. Okay, thus have I heard. That's what it means. It means I was not there, but this is what I've heard from hearsay. The idiom that you use when you say you've heard it yourself is Sammukha Metang. Sutang, Sammukha Patigahitang. And this one is used quite frequently in the suttas. Okay, so it literally is, Mukha is from the mouth, and Sammukha is face to face, like with directly from the mouth, or from mouth to mouth, or lip to lip, or something like that.
If I use the tongue, indicate I just heard it from somebody else, or does it indicate I heard it from somebody else who was there?
It doesn't, it's not specific, yeah. Just heard it from, it means that you weren't there, yeah. There was an occasion when, and this is what he's heard from his mum, okay?
A bit unclear about what it says, who does not say I go to Master Gotama for refuge?
Prince Bodhi. So he just rejoices in what the Buddha said, but then he doesn't say I'll go for refuge. And then his friend, Sanjay Kaputta, who is the one who went to get the Buddha and bring him in the first place, he says, why don't you go to the Buddha for refuge? And he says, don't say that. I heard this from my mother's lips, and the word he's using from translating mother here is actually Aya. Literally like from the Venerable Lady's lips, Ayaya. There was an occasion when the Blessed One was living in Kosambi in Ghosita's park. Then my mother, who was pregnant, went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, she sat down at one side and said to him, Venerable Sir, the prince or princess in my womb, whichever it may be, goes to the Blessed One for refuge and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of bhikkhus. Let the Blessed One remember this child as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. Okay? So that's pretty dedicated. Kuchigato yome ayang bhante kuchigato kumarako wa kumarikawa. Okay, and then on another occasion, when the Blessed One was living in the country of the Bhagas at Sungsumara Gira at the Behesakala Grove in the deer park, then my nurse, carrying me on her hip, went to the Blessed One, the nurse being Dhati, it's being a wet nurse, carried me on her hip, went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, she stood at one side and said to him, Venerable Sir, this Prince Bodhi goes to the Blessed One for refuge and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of bhikkhus. Let the Blessed One remember him as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. Now, my dear Sanjay Kaputta, for the third time I go to the Blessed One for refuge and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of bhikkhus. Let the Blessed One remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. So interesting that this is the only time that I'm aware of that this custom is mentioned, that the baby, even in the womb, is made to go for refuge. But interesting that even though he has been a disciple of the Buddha since his whole life, he still has this, or seems to have this kind of Jaina view, pleasure is not to be gained through pleasure, pleasure is to be gained through pain. He doesn't actually say that he's kind of adheres to this view, but at least it's kind of occurred to him. So I think it's probably quite common that you know, he might be an adherent but not necessarily particularly know much about the teachings. Yeah, and also interesting that this must be that little detail in a sense gives us a clue as to the relative chronology of the text, which is something which is very hard to figure out and which you can only work out piece by piece. Now, he's now obviously a grown man, and must be at least in his 20s, but he was taken to see the Buddha when he was a baby, where he was still in the mother's womb. So that means that this discourse must be given in the last half of the Buddha's dispensation. So even though that's not very specific, But at least it gives you some idea that it must have been towards the end somewhere. Right. So any more questions? Comments?
This is a huge...
Sorry?
What's the actual, like, use that knowledge for transition or something?
Yeah.
Because of what I do, what Buddha says, and what I'm teaching or not. So, what's the formal active forms
for
refuge?
Yeah, well,
it sounds like a bad
physical. Does, yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, normally, normally we think of it as a much more, it's a reflective thing, you know, that you hear the teachings, you consider it, and then you decide to do that. Whereas here, it's obviously becoming, as you say, more like a baby's crying, pour some water over his head, and yeah. Yeah. But I suppose maybe it has a meaning for the mother, so that she's like having this kind of the sense that she's going to be raising the child with kind of Buddhist values and so on. So maybe that's the idea.
Maybe it was asking to sort of relate yourself to the teacher.
Maybe.
The fact that he knows the Jain teaching, it sort of puts it in context that the Buddha is just one teacher and one teacher.
Yeah.
And
I'm not aware of a custom like that. And it seems, as I said, this is a unique occurrence as far as I'm aware. And Sanji Kaputa is his friend and he didn't seem to know about it. So, not sure why. It's one of those things.
What
happened
with the
dead turkey?
Yeah.
As a baby.
There's a lot of people taking it.
Not when they're in the womb.
No, but I mean, just that it's not in the womb.
Yeah.
So that's what's unique about this one, it's in the womb. But I would have thought that you could take refuge actually nearly in the womb.
Well, normally you think of it as an intentional act.
Yes,
but
it could be related to something that the Chinese people do. In the Buddhist families, when a person conceives a baby and they want to teach the baby, the teaching starts when the baby is in the womb. That we call it Tai Jiao.
Tai Jiao.
Tai is the womb, Jiao is teaching. So when a person conceives the baby, the teaching starts when the baby is conceived in the womb. So the mother and the father have to do a lot of things in order that the baby learns it even from the womb. So the training of the child begins when they are in the womb, not after they have been born.
Typical Chinese, isn't it? They won't give you any rest. You have to.
They're having
after hours tutors and stuff.
Yeah, but
with the hope that the child will continue their Buddhist practice as long as they don't actually become a nun. It's kind of that kind of delicate balance, you know.
I lament so often when I see practitioners seemingly making the grave mistake of not being educated about a basic point of Buddhism. I can see from the suttas and from the commentaries that it's just a tendency of mind. That tendency of mind is being alive ever since it's thrill. So there's the instance here of Prince Bodhi, who went forth when he was a fetus and still misunderstands the doctrine of pleasure and pain from pain. And then the commentaries, such outstanding attempts to rationalize doctrines which are obviously contradicting the Buddhist teachings. And from, you might assume, from people who must have known the sutras as well,
yeah.
attempt, and he goes to refuge like every day, or, you know, he does it three times, and actually already the first time he went to feed him for a life, and he does it again and again.
So we could adopt him.
Yeah, it's true. Also,
really, like, you can't keep doing it. But the point of the sutta was that he was kind of criticised because he didn't go for refuge, and he said, "Oh no, I actually have already." Yeah, but yeah, no reason you can't keep on doing it.
And it's also a half commitment. It's like someone asks you, "Rely on for your practice," and once you know in your heart what you rely on,
probably a very Indian thing. Actually, the Buddhan Saranagachami idea is one kind of relic of Buddhism which is still very common in Indian popular culture. Most people will actually know that, like, oh, they'll say, "Do you Buddhan Saranagachami?" They actually know that. Yeah. But I don't know, that's just such a common phenomenon. Yeah, it's sort of just been retained down in the popular culture. Yeah, it's like, well, we say Amen at the end of prayers in Christianity, when it's actually Amun Ra is the ancient Egyptian god. But so we still pay homage to him at the end of every prayer. Why not? Yeah. Okay, so let's finish by paying respects.